Live and local, we are Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game, KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time for RP3 and Company, where Raymond Parch III and Cody Schutz talk sports with the biggest names in the state of Louisiana. Raging Cajun legend Brian Mitchell.
My dream was always to play in the NFL, so having an opportunity was the main thing I needed.
LSU College World Series hero Warren Morris.
I don't get tired of talking about it. You know, if people remember me for that home run and winning that championship, I think that's great.
Time to find out what's behind that door as RP3 and Company starts now.
Lavelle Rose up the middle, looking, cutting, shooting, go! Lavelle to another U.S. That's it. U.S. wins their fourth World Cup.
Good morning. Welcome back to RP3 and Company. Live right here on Acadiana Sports Station 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. You can also find us on the simulcast Stadium Network 32.1. That's 24 hours of sports coverage free over the air. You can also find us on LUS Fiber 133 and 1133 in high definition if you'd like to. In case you had forgotten over the long holiday weekend, the Tharco Equipment Hotline is 337-706-0111. That's 337-706-0111. Got to start off things on the right foot. Cody Schutz! Good morning to you, brother. How was your extended holiday weekend? I see that you've survived it.
Yes, we survived it. It was a good weekend. I enjoyed myself thoroughly. Wish it was a little bit longer, but, you know, that's always the case.
If you were wondering, ladies and gentlemen, was Cody Schutz chanting USA still?
Oh, well.
Still, when I walked into the 237 Roof Studios? Absolutely. Yes, he did. We got plenty to get to with the extended holiday break being off on Thursday. And then Friday, we just had our best of show. So we're going to get to it all. We're going to talk about Zion Williamson making his debut for the New Orleans Pelicans. And then there was an earthquake in Vegas. It's an interesting weekend. We'll also want to talk a little bit about a former LSU star making a name for himself for the Pels in his first two summer league games as well. And does the former Tiger have a future on the roster for the Pels? We'll also be diving into Astros baseball. We're at the All-Star break. Home Run Derby is tonight. We'll help preview that and much, much more. But we're going to start off today's show with the Women's World Cup. The U.S. Women's National Team won their record-setting fourth World Cup and did so in dominating fashion. Fourth World Cup. That's the most by any country. It's also their second straight World Cup as they repeated as champions. And they went out and took care of business. And we kept saying it on the show, and Cody kept bringing it up over and over again, was, okay, this is the toughest competition that they faced. It was France, it was Spain, and then it was England. And along the way, this U.S. women's national team's taken a ton of heat. Started off right off the bat versus Thailand, when they scored 13 goals and were criticized for celebrating scoring goal after goal after goal by people in the media and other countries. That's how their World Cup started off, being immensely criticized for scoring goals. And then they were criticized again throughout the rest of the tournament. Then Alex Morgan caught heat for her sipping tea celebration versus England in the semifinals. By the way, England, who then turned around and lost the third place game. And they get to the finals versus the Netherlands. And they just take care of business right off the bat. Right off the bat. You knew that this was not going to, that this was not going to be an upset. You saw it early. It was on early Sunday morning. You just felt that this was a team that was just going to come out and take care of business. 2-0 may not sound like a lopsided score, but in the world of soccer, it is. 4th World Cup overall, back-to-back. Megan scored the goal. That was a penalty kick. Is that correct, Cody, at the 61st minute?
Yeah, it was. It wasn't called originally, and then they went back and little video-assisted referee, a challenge, if you will, went back, took a look at it, the ref, and then she came out and decided that it was a penalty.
There we go.
And then just buried immediately, never in doubt.
And that helped her lock up the golden boot.
Right.
Because her and Alex Morgan were tied with 6 goals each for the entire tournament.
And Rapinoe was technically in first place because then it goes to assists after that if the goals are tied. So
Rapinoe got the golden boot. Alex Morgan got the silver boot. The future of the U.S. Women's National Program in many ways. How do you pronounce Rose's last name, Cody?
Lavelle.
Lavelle.
Yeah, and remember, who did Cody say during the group play was, to me, looked like
could be the breakout star,
standout player on this team, and the girl to look for and the name to pay attention to in the future for this U.S. Women's National Team, Rose Lavelle, and then for her to have a huge moment like that in the championship game, that only is going to build her pedigree even farther. So when she returns to national play for the United States, she'll be that much more experienced and seasoned and confident. And, you know, just want to pat myself on the back real quick, if you don't mind.
So you get to see the most dominant player on the team score a goal in the World Cup final, and you get to see the future of the women's national team score a goal as well. And look, they came into this as the defending World Cup champions. They came into this as the favorite. And I'll say this about the U.S. Women's National Team. All of the kind of knocks that we have when it comes to soccer and kind of the half-ass reasons why people have not latched onto it here in this country, or why we don't latch onto it, they give you no excuse for that. They take away all those excuses. The notion of, well, you don't score enough in soccer. Well, the U.S. Women's National Team says, no, don't worry, we'll take care of that. And yet they're criticized for it, which I just find interesting. They score goals. They have recognizable names. Okay, Alex Morgan is one of the most well-known athletes on the planet. They are out there. They're visible. They have name recognition. They score goals. They play the game the right way. They're efficient. They're dominant. And they obviously enjoy the game. So what's not to like, what's not to love about what they bring to the table? And they win. And they win.
And that just proves the point that it's not so much what they stand for or even what they bring to the table, the U.S. Women's National Team. It's more in which the vessel that they present themselves, that being soccer, is right. Just a, you know, it's that's a proof to me that, you know, it doesn't really matter how compelling a team may be, because, I mean, this team should be getting way more love than they are, in my humble opinion.
And it's also, right, and maybe over some time will help put them back, put them in the spotlight and have this view them.
I mean, they'll probably win an ESPY that's coming up for Team of the Year. They'll probably beat Toronto, the Raptors, and, you know, they'll probably be Team of the Year. And that'll, unfortunately, be the most praise they get after the World Cup.
The negativity about this team, though, started right off the bat. Like, it feels now that you look back over the tournament, and it feels like, I don't know if this is because they were the defending World Cup champion, or because they're Team USA, I'm not for sure. But damn, the backlash was just ready. It was primed up, right? It was ready to go, and they just needed an excuse to rail against the U.S. Women's National Team. And they go out there and they whoop up on poor Thailand in the very first match, and everyone came out. Everyone showed their teeth, so to speak, and were like, oh, well, this team's disrespectful, and this team does this, and boom. The negativity surrounding this team started off right off the bat. Just right off the bat. And it was like, okay. Like, I haven't seen that with a men's national team. At least I don't remember whether that's an Olympic team or a World Cup team. You just don't. There was just a negativity around this women's national team. And maybe because they're outspoken, and maybe because they're highly visible. But they are by far, improved it once again. The most dominant women's soccer team in the world.
I'll say this right before we go into break. I was talking to my wife about this on the ride home. Excuse me, on the ride home from Marksville yesterday. And I hesitate to use the word easy, but the United States dominated this World Cup, say for a few minutes in maybe the Spain game and a few minutes in the game against France. It was never in doubt. So I hesitate to use the word, but I'm going to use it. This World Cup victory for the United States women's national team was borderline easy. That's how much better they were than their competition. So take that for what it is, but that's what I think. This was almost easy for those girls.
It also feels like, and I'll piggyback off of what Cody said, and we'll keep the discussion going after the break. It feels like there's a lack of appreciation for just how good this team is. And I think Cody's kind of alluding to it, where they make it look so easy that there's no obstacles. There was really no obstacles for them to overcome. They weren't necessarily tested throughout this World Cup. So a lot of times you need that moment of your backup is against the wall, and that's when everyone kind of, you know, comes behind you, right? They rally for you. They cheer you on because, oh, you're on the brink of elimination, or you have some adversity to get past. This Women's World Cup team really didn't have that. They're very much kind of in the midst of a little mini dynasty, so it just felt like they made it look so easy. I think people are taking it for granted, and I don't know. They just rub people the wrong way, and we can have a deeper discussion on that if we'd like. Right now, we got to hit a break. If you want to, you can give us a call on the ARCO Equipment Hotline, 337-706-0111. That's 337-706-0111. We'll keep the World Cup discussion going. We'll also talk about the men when we come back after this break. Right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. We're also simulcast on Stadium Network 32.1. That's 24 hours of sports coverage free over the air. You can also find us on LUS Fiber 133 and 1133 in high definition. We started off today's show talking about the Women's World Cup. Team USA wins its second consecutive and fourth overall World Cup, doing so in dominating fashion, beating the Netherlands 2-0. Cody, I'm looking back over it here. The women's Team USA gave up a total of 3 goals.
That sounds right.
The entire World Cup.
Yeah.
3. They scored 2 themselves in the championship match. They only gave up 3. 3. They outscored their opponents 26-3.
That's not normal for anyone who doesn't.
Thank you. That's
watch
what, yes,
soccer,
yes, okay.
Or just, you know, follow just, soccer. That is just, not having a goal differential of plus 23 is not a thing you normally do in an international tournament. You know, maybe some like Pee Wee leagues here and there, maybe, but at the highest level of international soccer, you do not go plus 23 in your goal differential. But apparently, this U.S. women's national team does.
Most goals, correct me if I'm wrong here, Cody, most goals scored by a team in the World Cup?
Yeah, they beat Germany, had the record. I think they scored 1 or possibly 2 more goals than Germany, but at least 1. Yeah, they have the record.
So an absolute dominating performance from start to finish. They win the World Cup. They do so in dominating fashion. The Golden Boot Award goes to them. The Silver Boot Award goes to them. And a good majority of this team is returning back. I want to say for the next World Cup, everyone should be back on this team. I'm not for sure. Alex Morgan just turned 30, so she should still be part of the team. Cody talked about the young lady Rose, who's blossoming into a star. She could become the face of Team USA. So, back-to-back World Cup championships for Team USA. We're going to head out to the ARCO Equipment Hotline and welcome on James to the show. James, good morning to you. I hope you had a great 4th of July holiday weekend. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing fine, yourself. You're talking about the women's World Cup team and some of the backsides they received. And I watched a good number of their matches that they played. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to watch the championship game yesterday, but I did catch some of the highlights. You know, and what killed me about all this backlash is one from America, you know, and it was extremely harsh from American males in the national media, you know, talking about you mentioned the game against Thailand and their outspokenness. And I'm like, you get this in American men's sports all the time.
Absolutely, James, yeah.
Blowouts and bravado and talking and this and that. And you never hear this type of backlash from, especially again, the males in American sports media and males in America in general. They're like, well, if your team isn't good enough to compete and don't put them on the field, or if you get outscored by a team or a team piles up the points on you, score more than they did. You know, you hear that type of stuff, and not in the case of these women. You know, this team here, they don't get paid as much as the American men's team, but yet they outsell them merchandise-wise. But yet, you know, again, they don't get paid as much. You know, they're a much better team. They're a way more competitive team than the American men's soccer team. So, you know, as of now, hasn't always been the case, but as of now, the last decade or so, they have been better, hands down. You know, and to say it was easy, I'm not going to say it was easy because it diminishes what they did. It gives life to these cretins who always are looking to bash them, saying, oh, well, they're so much better than everyone else. They should have won. No, let's not diminish what these young women did. They did a great thing. Americans should be proud of them all. Unfortunately, you have those who aren't, you know, but it is what it is. I say go Team USA. They got some really good players coming up from the junior team that'll be on this, the next World Cup team, and combined with these veterans that'll be there, I think they'll win another one.
James, appreciate the phone call. He makes some terrific points. They dominate their sport. They're back-to-back World Cup champions. They've won four overall. They're rock stars. They have the best players on the planet in their sport play for Team USA. And yet, I hate to bring it up, and James did it for me, they get paid less than the men do. They get paid less than the men do, and they're a far better product than the men are.
During the trophy presentation ceremony, there were chants from the crowd of equal pay. Like a wrestling event, the chant was crowding equal pay as the trophy presentation was underway.
What is that?
It's not just a small movement anymore. It's becoming a worldwide, international, global type thing, which...
And the women's
all good.
And the women's national team is still in the process of suing U.S. Soccer because of the equal pay issue. We're still in the middle of that, and they've been critical of FIFA. Darren Revelle tweeted this out yesterday: the U.S. women, should they win today, which they ended up doing, would make about $250,000 each from winning the World Cup. Right? If the U.S. men had ever won. Under their current deal, they'd make more than $1.1 million each. They can't even win a minor tournament over the weekend. Congratulations, you finished as runner-up in a non-World Cup tournament. Bravo. We got to hit a break. But this is RP3 and Company right here on Acadiana's Sports Station. 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. We led off today's show talking about the Women's World Cup. Team USA wins its second consecutive World Cup championship, fourth overall. That's the most by any country. Do so in dominating fashion. Gave up only three goals the entire World Cup tournament, outscoring their opponents 26-3. That's not close. That's not close. And mind you, they had three matches in the tournament that were one-goal matches, and they still dominated the tournament as they did. We spent the first two segments of today's show talking about that. We're going to head out to the ARCO Equipment Hotline and welcome on our second caller of the day. His name is James as well, but it's a different James. James, hope you had a great holiday weekend. Welcome to the show. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How we doing, guys?
We're doing great, man. We're doing great. What you got? What's on your mind, my friend?
Quick comment on the equality of the pay. Instead of beating up the regulatory body that governs that and runs it, we should look at ourselves as a society. You know, who goes to the games? What drives the ticket sales? Who are the sponsors? It's no different from the WNBA and the NBA, right? Do you know anybody who's went to a women's soccer game? Are we buying the tickets? Are we going out there and supporting them? Or do we wait until they win a World Cup, and then we jump up and down and holler they should make the same amount of money?
James, I want to touch on a couple of points and keep them on. I think the sport itself lends itself to being a sport that most Americans care about for every 4 years, whether that's women or men. I think just soccer is that way. And I think it's always been that case. I think anytime you have any one of those Olympic sports, it's kind of that way, right? I mean, how many people are going to diving competitions or going to swimming competitions when it's not the Olympics, right? It's just one of those things that cycle in. It's a valid point there. My only thing about the equal pay issue, and I think you're right there that we have to take a look in the mirror, but jersey sales are trending in the other direction. Nike's reporting that the women's national team jersey is its highest selling soccer jersey of any team that it produces, and the sponsorships have gone up in recent years. I think that's where it's coming in, is that the performance on the field since the 2015 World Cup, and the fact that the women's games are now generating more money. But you are right. If regular just Joe Smith out there cared more about the women's national team, maybe that would force the federation to make a change, right? I mean, if there was enough outcry to say, hey, this is what we're going to do, this is demanded to do so, we want to have this, maybe that would change it on a little bit more. But you're right. I mean, it is an easy topic to go, well, why aren't the women being paid more? Why don't we discuss this? Why aren't we discussing this 2 years ago in between, when it's a non-World Cup year?
Right, that's my point. I mean, I'm not saying they don't deserve it. I'm just saying we drive it.
Correct. Good phone call. Thank you, James. Thank you. And his valid point there is, now I think...
Now, James, I will say this. When the United States, when the women's national team, and maybe this is my... Maybe I'm part of the problem here. And not part of the problem, but after the previous World Cup 4 years ago, the women's national team did their championship tour where they came back to the United States and they went all around the country. They played a game in the Superdome. I bought a ticket to that game. I went to the Superdome. I didn't buy a jersey, but I bought a scarf. You know, you see the soccer scarves they have. I have one of those U.S. women's national team deal. In fairness, you know, to James's point, I don't want to, you know, beat around the bush. I didn't necessarily go, and maybe they didn't come near me, but I didn't necessarily go and look for another U.S. women's national team game or event
or anything
between that last championship tour and then this World Cup coming up. So maybe James has a valid point, is even someone like me who loves soccer, I love the sport, but that women's national team kind of slipped my mind for about 3.5 years there in between last World Cup and this one, and I don't have anybody to blame for that but me.
It's a valid point.
Yeah.
It's a valid point, and where do you go? What can you do moving forward?
It's not
forward?
The TV exposure thing, because the women are on TV now just as much as the men for their random games you'll catch in the middle of like November or something.
And this is something I read from the Washington Post. It says, overall, from fiscal 2016-18, the women's games generated about $900,000 more revenue than the men's games did. So they were nearly $1 million more profitable than the men's. And in the year following the 2015 World Cup win, women's games have generated $1.9 million more than the men's games. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm a little surprised by that number. And in recent years, the men's revenue tally also includes the fees that opposing teams pay in order to play the United States. So, yeah. The men's revenue tally also includes the fees that opposing teams pay in order to play the United States. Now, once again, and here's the other thing that I think is the biggest difference. Not only we can discuss the level of play and the fact that the women's team is a far better machine. It's a well-oiled machine compared to the men's team. The men's national team is a bit of a mess. We always talk about the men's national team as, oh, they're making progress. They're about to turn the corner, and I've heard that conversation now for 20-plus years.
It's a wide corner.
It's a very wide corner for the men's national team. The women, the women's national team has their act together. They know how to develop the players. We talked about it before, where you had someone like Amy Wambach and Hope Solo leave the team out from the last World Cup, and you have other players simply step up. Right, and they're just ready,
right.
And they're ready for the spotlight, and they're ready to go into the biggest stage, and they're ready to dominate the sport. So
a point that someone brought up to me on the phone that I think is an interesting thought. It maybe points the fingers more at the U.S. women's national team themselves when it comes to this pay thing, because you discussed it. You say, you know, these girls win or get a $250,000 or so, around $250,000, right, is what you said, for winning this World Cup.
Yeah.
And the men, if the United States men were to ever win the World Cup, right?
Sorry,
right, of course.
Sorry.
But they would get over $1 million. They'd get around $1.1 or so million dollars
correct.
Each. Someone brings up to me that in 2015, the Women's World Cup made $79 million as a total, as a whole. Whereas a couple of years later in the Men's World Cup, it made $4 billion. It's just the Men's World Cup, he said, like countries like Saudi Arabia and things like that, that maybe in Qatar and places like that, that don't really care about the Women's World Cup because their teams don't get there. They don't have women's national teams, maybe.
Or there's several countries that don't allow their women
well,
to even take part.
Yeah,
take part in
that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have other countries that care much, much, much more, put all of their resources into the men's game as opposed to the women's game. So if that is the reason why the women are winning substantially less amounts of money for the same prize, what would seem, then maybe we should take a look even more at ourselves and say then we should make up the difference then with the sponsors and with, you know, the Hulu commercials and with the Snickers bars and the jersey sales and stuff like that, because there is a disparity in the amount of money that each tournament brings in, and it is a wide, we're talking billions of dollars difference in money that each tournament brings in.
The men's World Cup has been around for more than 100 years.
Yeah, there's only, what, been eight World Cup champions, I think,
right,
in the women's.
The women started in 91.
Yeah,
official.
The U.S.
Official women's
right.
World
U.S.
Cup.
U.S. has four, Germany has two, and then a couple other countries have one each.
So that's part of it. It is also part that so many of the several dozens upon dozens of countries don't even have a women's national team. That's part of it as well. So it's a little bit later coming in, so you have generations of sponsorships that are kind of built into the men's side. But regardless of if other countries are part of this or not, shouldn't the federation here stateside take care of the women? Like if you're running a business, right? I mean, in a lot of ways, this is a business. The women's national team is representing your brand in your country better than the men. So why are you paying this group over here substantially more money to be an inferior product? Right? I mean, that's what it kind of boils down to for me. You have two products. One is mediocre. You're paying a ton of money for a mediocre product. The other one is you're not paying as much for and is the best in the world. Right? Like, you don't keep paying. If you go to a restaurant, Cody, and you get poor service or you get a poor meal over and over again, you're going to stop going, right? You're not going to keep going. You're not going to keep paying your money for that. So that's the thing that bothers me about this, is that you keep paying the inferior product more and it doesn't produce. And you have this other product over here that is producing, and it's the best in the world by far. It's considered to be the absolute best in the world. Why not just pay them equally? Or why not just start having the men and be like, hey, you have to earn it. Just because you're the men's national team doesn't mean that you... I mean, and here's the other thing. The women have bigger stars. Name me two current men's national team stars, Cody.
Christian Pulisic and Michael Bradley.
The first two names I think of when I think of the men's national team are guys that are no longer on it.
Landon Donovan and Clint Dempsey.
Right.
Those are the names you think of. Yep.
And Howard.
Oh, and Tim Howard, do call.
Okay. So, and that's who I think of because those were the stars.
And then Giassi, Zardes. The thing is, these guys have Landon Donovan and Clint Dempsey, Tim Howard, they all had moments in their career, whether they were, you know, MLS
quarters,
MLS moments,
well,
or whether they were World Cup moments. Also, they beat Mexico in the finals of the Gold Cup, which the United States team this time around just lost. Those guys were successful in that. I think it's the only time the United States has beat Mexico in the finals.
That was a big deal.
Of the Gold Cup. So yep. Those guys had something to hang their hat on. This, and Michael Bradley is like the last kind of piece of that core
remnant
that's still
that
hanging
there.
On. Now it's a lot of younger guys, Giassi Zardes and Christian Pulisic. And Pulisic has a huge upside. He just signed with Chelsea for the highest contract of any American soccer player ever. So, I mean, there's things to look at to be hopeful, but the track record of this team is what makes you hesitant.
And how they're organized and how that's a bigger concern.
And, they're almost like the Browns in a sense until now, that no one wants to coach him. No one of any clout that could really stir up some excitement. No one wants to come in and manage the club.
No. Why would you? It's kind of been a dumpster fire.
Kinda.
A little bit.
Yeah.
And it's like the women's national team, meanwhile, is a well-oiled machine. So once again, congrats to Team USA. Terrific phone calls to start off. People are ready. They're recharged. They got their holiday weekend behind them. They're ready to hit the week off strong, and they're doing it with us. We appreciate it. We got to hit a break. More RP3 and Company coming up next, right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to the show. We got to close out hour number one, talking a little bit about Tony Robichaud. They held a memorial service yesterday at the Cajun Dome Convention Center. Thousands poured into the convention center from 3 to 9 p.m. to help honor the winningest baseball coach in Raging Cajun history and probably the most respected coach of any sport in Raging Cajun athletic history. Tony Robichaud's family, of course, was there on hand and displayed a ton of class as well. Robichaud will be buried today. The funeral will be set at Our Lady of Fatima Catholic Church following a viewing and visitation from 10 to 2 p.m. today. The longtime Raging Cajun head coach who just wrapped up his 25th year. We talked about it on last week's shows. Passed away at the age of 57 last week following his second surgery due to a heart attack that he suffered. It was a stunning loss, not only for the UL family, but Raging Cajun Athletics, and of course all of Acadiana. His family was on hand yesterday, though. Showed a ton of class as thousands came through the convention center. Anthony Babineaux did speak to members of the media yesterday. That's the longtime assistant coach. And he said that the family, quote, they're handling it very, very well. I'm sure in the next couple days, I'm sure they're going to break down. At least I hope they do. They're going to need to, end quote. He also further talked about how Tony's wife, Colleen, was actually consoling people that were coming through. When asked about how the team is doing, Babineaux had this to say, quote, the team is doing okay. When we reached out to them Wednesday after he had passed, some of the conversations were difficult. Everybody expresses themselves differently and grieves differently. Some guys broke down right away, and other guys, they just couldn't believe it. Babineaux further stated, we had been keeping them up to date on his condition, so I don't think there was a shock that he did pass. The last message that I sent to the team was more explicit with it than the prior one, so they knew he was in very, very critical condition. So an outpouring of support, not surprised that thousands of people poured into the convention center. Babineaux also spoke about that. Quote, seeing the thousands of people pouring into this convention center to pay their last respects to him, I'm comforted to know that for the last 25 years I've been able to work side by side with him, learn some invaluable lessons, and help him teach these kids the way they're supposed to do things. I've been blessed to be part of his life for the last 25 years. So once again, Tony Robichaud, the longtime Raging Cajun baseball coach who passed away last week on Wednesday of last week after having two surgeries following a heart attack. He will be laid to rest today at Our Lady of Fatima Catholic Church. There will be a viewing and visitation from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the church this morning. Not surprised, though, by the outpouring of support for Tony. And I would agree with that statement that he may be the most respected coach in Raging Cajun athletic history. Of all the coaches I've dealt with in my time with the Raging Cajuns, he was the one that I was asked about, or when I talked to people in the community, whether it was my neighbors. I have a big RCAF guy, a big Raging Cajun booster that lives right next to me, next door to me. Charles is a huge Raging Cajun fan. We always talk about the coaches, and you know, we always talk about the state of athletics with the Raging Cajuns. And when we talk to Tony, it's always the utmost respect. Everyone always had this huge amount of respect for Tony and what he did and what he brought to the program and how he carried himself. How he carried himself, how he not only carried himself, but how he carried the Raging Cajun brand, the school, the city, the entire region. It's a huge loss for all of us here throughout Acadiana. But it is something to see the thousands of people that came out and paid their respects to the longtime baseball coach yesterday there at the Cajun Convention Center. And expect even more tributes to continue pouring in throughout this process in the days and weeks coming, in the years coming. Because that's how much Tony Robichaux meant to UL, to the city of Lafayette, and to all of Acadiana. That's going to do it for hour number one. When we come back here on hour number two, we'll talk Pels right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game.
Live and local on Acadiana's number one sports station, 103.7 The Game. It's time for RP3 and Company, where Raymond Parks III and Cody Schutz talk sports with the biggest names in the state of Louisiana. Pro Football Hall of Famer Ricky Jackson.
I tell you what, man, I was out playing basketball, and a lot of guys came and told me thanks draft or two, and they looking for you. I had forgot all about the draft.
UFC superstar Dustin the Diamond Poirier.
It means everything to me. You know, Lafayette, Louisiana, I was born and raised. I'm a Cajun. I love it. I can't wait to walk through the airport with that belt.
Time to find out what's behind that door as RP3 and Company starts now.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of RP3 and Company right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. We spent the majority of hour number one discussing the U.S. Women's National Team winning their second consecutive World Cup Championship, fourth overall, most all time. Did so in dominating fashion, outscoring their opponents during the entire World Cup tournament, 26-3. 26-3 domination by the U.S. women's national team, and just an impressive feat and one that deserves to be recognized. But I want to take a little time now to switch gears a little bit, head to the hardwood. Typically don't talk about Pelicans during the summer. We usually don't have an excuse to. And we typically don't really get excited about the Summer League But Zion Williamson made his debut over the weekend, Friday night there in Las Vegas. He only played for 9 minutes and some change. Suffered a slight mild injury where he hit knee to knee with another player. The Pels have gone ahead and taken precautionary measures to shut him down for the rest of the summer league. We talked about it even before then on last week's show that, you know, he'll play in the one game, but don't expect it to go any further than that. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. He gets injured, so they just went ahead and already have announced that they've shut him down for the remainder of the summer league. Apparently, they sold thousands of tickets for the summer league because, apparently, of Zion Williamson. And so there'll be some disappointment there, but people did see him. It was an electric atmosphere on Friday night. And the big fella for the Pels had this move that when I watched it, and I did watch it. Yes, right. I watched Summer League basketball. When you saw it happen, I was like, did he just do that? Did that just happen? And he did it against one of the guys that people had talked about the Pels trading for when Anthony Davis was still rumored to possibly go into the Pelicans as Kevin Knox. Young player, plays for the New York Knicks. Well, Zion Williamson embarrassed poor Kevin Knox by doing this. He just did this.
Blew it inside. Robinson tapped it out to Knox. Zion rips it. Oh, yeah, it's time to get in the gym.
Looks like he's got a corral. Mr. Williamson says, no, sir. Let me show you how I do it. My goodness. Knox, he just takes it right away, Mark.
Knox had the ball. Zion stood up, grabbed the ball, ripped it out of his hands, and then took it and just slammed it. And just a big, huge, powerful dunk. That's why you heard the crowd just go absolutely berserk. Another human had their hands on the ball. Another strong human, far stronger than Cody and I. Knox is built. He's an NBA player, okay? And Zion was like, give me that, and just rips the ball out of his hand and then just puts down a big old powerful dunk. That's all I needed to see. That's all I needed to see. I needed to see a guy giving effort on the defensive end of the ball and then displaying his athleticism by just throwing the ball inside the hoop as hard as possible. Just absolutely monstrous. And I guess we can blame Zion Williamson's 9 minutes of glory for what occurred next, because the game between the New York Knicks and the New Orleans Pelicans in the Summer League there in Vegas on Friday night was stopped and canceled due to an earthquake. The game was not even, it was not even.
Is that like a metaphor for something? An earthquake? Like literally an earthquake?
Literally an earthquake.
Okay.
Occurred in Vegas, and they had to stop the Summer League game and never finish playing it. They rewarded the win to the Pels.
That doesn't matter.
But
it's like baseball. We got past the seventh inning, so we'll go ahead and give it to you.
So this is, if you're there, and by the way, The Pelicans-Knicks Summer League game, this is from our friend Rod Walker of The Advocate, which ended early because of the earthquake, was the highest-rated Summer League game ever. Ever. That's how much buzz is about Zion Williamson. Now, of course, R.J. Barrett, his former teammate there with the Blue Devils, was the number 3 overall pick in the draft. He's playing for the Knicks, so that's a bit of a matchup there. So it's kind of a marquee matchup. But they all came to see Zion, okay? That's what they were there for. The highest-rated Summer League game ever. the top five markets. And this is the telling thing here. You're thinking, okay, well, it's in Vegas. It's a Friday night. It's a summer league game, right? Everyone's wanting to watch Zion. So it's going to be national markets that are all about wanting to watch Zion. No. The top five markets for the Pelicans-Knicks summer league game on Friday night: New Orleans, Memphis, Norfolk, Virginia, Raleigh, Durham, and Greensboro.
Small markets of the world, unite.
And flex their muscle. Once again, you can be a star. This isn't the 80s where you have to play in L.A. or New York to be a star. We view our sports differently now. We digest them differently. We don't need, they don't have to be in major media markets to be immensely successful and popular. It's just not how it is. Not anymore. It's just not how it is anymore. So, yes, Zion displayed his defensive abilities. They make the decision afterwards, and this was over the weekend. David Griffin released a statement, quote, "In an abundance of caution, we have made the determination that Zion will not appear in game action for the remainder of the NBA Summer League. He will continue to take part in training and conditioning with our performance team," end quote. That's the right decision. You show the people, you gave the people a glimpse of what the big fella is going to be doing moving forward. He didn't disappoint. There was an earthquake as well. Shut down the Summer League. Highest rated Summer League game in history. People are amped about Zion Williamson. But Zion wasn't the only Pel making noise. The other one is a former LSU Tiger you may know of. He had himself a quiet weekend as well in Vegas. And that, ladies and gentlemen, was Cavale Bigby Williams. Cavale Bigby Williams played in two games for the Pels for the Summer League. And he recorded a pair of double-doubles in both games, averaging 13 points and 12 rebounds in his two Summer League games for the Pels. Now, Andrew Lopez is telling us that Cavale Bigby Williams has a high interest in inking with the Pels. Sources told him that he's been offered an E10 contract. Okay. That's an Exhibit 10 deal. But that he's still weighing his options, but that Cavale Bigby Williams does have high interest in inking with the Pels. The guy is playing in the Summer League. I understand it's the Summer League. But this cat, we saw what he was able to do at LSU. He was a glue guy. He did great dirty work for the Tigers last year, helping them get to the Sweet 16. Tremendous team leader, high character guy. If I'm the Pels and I can sign him to the cheap for barely nothing, I'm doing it all day long. So we'll have to keep our eyes out on if Cavale Bigby Williams is going to remain a New Orleans Pelican or if he's just simply had an opportunity to show off what he could do and show other teams that he's worthy of being on a roster. Either way, best of luck to Cavale Bigby Williams moving forward. But yes, a pair of double-doubles in his two Summer League games on Friday and Saturday. Former LSU Tiger there for the New Orleans Pelicans. Cody Worsham from LSU was tweeting out the best player at the Summer League. And he tweeted out a photo of Zion Williamson and Cavale Bigby Williams, and it said something like, "The best player in Summer League and Zion Williamson." So, but as great as Cavale Bigby Williams was, and as great as Zion was in the brief moments that we were able to see him, for the Pels, another player, a guy that's currently on the Pels roster, may have stole the show. And he's a former Duke player as well. And that's point guard Frank Jackson.
24-7. deal for these NBA players.
Boy, Jackson, oh! Catching a body in Las Vegas.
His stat line from Friday night's game. 30 points on 11 of 17 shooting, 5 from 9 from beyond the arc, three rebounds and 2 blocks in 24 minutes. And is the driving force behind New Orleans' win. And here's the thing about Frank Jackson. We've talked a lot on this show about what are the Pels going to do. Do they need a backup point guard? They got Lonzo Ball. They got plenty of number two guards, right? They got plenty of guys that can back up Drew Holiday, Josh Hart, who came over in the Lakers trade. By the way, all the trades were finally finalized over the weekend. That includes the Anthony Davis trade, and that includes the draft night trade with the Atlanta Hawks. All those trades are now finalized. All the guys are under contract now. The Derek Favors trade is done, so all that has been caught up. The front office there, the NBA's main office, is now all caught up with all those trade requests. That's all done, so the Pels are in good standing now with all that. But Jackson was a one-and-done guy at Duke, played for Coach K from 2015-16, and he's battled injury over the last couple of seasons. We've talked about the plethora of number two guards on the roster, but not a real backup veteran guy to back up Lonzo Ball. Could Frank Jackson be that guy? Do they already have Lonzo Ball's backup on the roster? Frank Jackson just hasn't proven to be healthy early on in his career. If he can remain healthy, the former Duke Blue Devil very easily could be the backup point guard. So maybe what you're seeing from Frank Jackson, who kind of stole the show over the weekend for the New Orleans Pelicans during their summer league games, could he be the guy to be the backup point guard for Lonzo Ball? We'll ask those questions and more with our good friend David Grubb, who will be joining us in hour number 3 at 8:32, breaking down all things Pelicans. Right now, though, we got to hit a break. You're listening to RP3 and Company right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to the show. I'm Raymond Parts III. I'm your host of RP3 and Company. Cody Schutz is the producer extraordinaire. We are refreshed, recharged from the holiday weekend, and so are you. You're listening to 103.7 The Game, Acadiana Sports Station. We just wrapped up some New Orleans Pelicans summer league talk. Zion Williamson made his debut, ripped the ball out of poor Kevin Knox's hands, and then powered it home in a brief 9 minutes of play for Zion in a game that was stopped by an earthquake. So memorable, I guess is the best way to describe that. KaVale Bigby Williams getting a pair of double-doubles in a couple games for the Pels. Maybe he'll be able to sign a contract with the team. And then Frank Jackson, could he be the point guard, backup point guard that the Pels have been looking for? Possibly. Right now, though, I want to talk a little baseball. Houston Astros wrapped up the first half of the season. It's technically not the first half. The first half's already come and gone. The All-Star game's not technically at the halfway point, but you know what I'm saying. Midsummer Classic is going to be here in a few days. Home Run Derby is tonight. We'll talk more about that in the next segment. All-Star Game will be on Tuesday. But the Astros wrapped up a series in dramatic fashion, downing the Halos 11-10 on Sunday. They finished the first half of the season 57-33. At the All-Star break, 57-33, first in the American League West. This is what the Astros have done at the All-Star break this year in the past three seasons. This year, 57-33. Last year, 64-35 when they reached the ALCS. 2017, they were 60-29. That's the year they won the World Series, and Altuve was named American League MVP. And the year before that, they were 48-41. So right where you expect them to be, phenomenal first half of the season. There was a scary moment in last night's game involving a former Raging Cajun that we need to talk about. Jonathan Lucroy was removed from the game following a collision at home plate. Reports are coming out that he was on his way to a local hospital for a CT scan and will be evaluated for a possible concussion and nose fracture. The former Raging Cajun star, Jake Marisnik, collided with him at the plate. And this is what Jake had to say, and he was very kind of shook up about things afterwards. But Jake said this, quote, he tweeted this out, quote, through my eyes, I thought the play was going to end up on the outside of the plate. I made a split-second decision at full speed to slide head first on the inside part of the plate. That decision got another player hurt, and I feel awful. I hope nothing but the best for at J. Lou Croy 20. When you watch it, I've seen it online, slow-mo down. The angle, Marisnik was already on the inside, and it does appear that Lou Croy might have been trying to block the plate, and it appears that Marisnik, in that split second, really had no way to avoid him. It is a vicious collision. Lou Croy's head just kind of, the helmet just pops right off of him, and he drops down. So we'll be keeping our fingers crossed and hope that Jonathan Lou Croy, the former Raging Cajun baseball star, is okay. And that it's nothing too serious.
We see less and less of this now, which is a good thing. That's Major League Baseball attempting to make a change to keep collisions at the plate and really at any base from being scary like this one is here. So we see less and less of it, but it's always going to be part of the game.
And like Jake said, he's barreling down the third baseline, right? And he's making a decision where he thought it was going to be on the inside. And, you know, he makes a split decision. And you could see him when you watch the replay. He makes that decision. You can see the look on Jake's face. He's like, oh hell. But then by that time, there's not, like, he has to commit to it, right? If he does anything else, he's just going to be out. So he's like, okay, well, I might as well just go right here and try to make the best of it I'm gonna have a collision with the catcher here. Unfortunate, obviously. You hate seeing that. It was a thrilling 10-inning game last night. Once again, the Astros won 11-10 to enter the Midsummer Classic at 57-33. George Springer, who's headed to the All-Star game at Progressive Field in Cleveland, he was 3 of 7. Jose Altuve, coming back into form again, 2 for 6. Bregman, he was hitless, but he did score a run because he drew 2 walks. He's headed to your All-Star game as well as the starting. He'll be starting in the infield. He'll also be taking part in the Home Run Derby, which we'll talk about here in the next segment. Michael Brantley, that's the way that you wrap up the first half of the season. 4 for 6 with 3 runs scored. Nice. And Jordan Alvarez, the young man who they play a little bit everywhere, first base, DH, left field. He's the 21-year-old out of Cuba. He was 3 for 5 with 3 RBIs. So the Astros, here they are, 57 wins. They win in walk-off fashion. And they're in a terrific shape. They got 6 All-Stars that are going to be taking part in the festivities in Cleveland this week, and congratulations to the Astros for that. But also, we're going to keep an eye on what's going on with Jonathan Lou Croy. Once again, vicious collision at the plate with Jake Marisnik. Lou Croy had to be carted off the field and was hospitalized afterwards. No update in the last 7 hours or so. So if something does break over in the next hour or so, we will let you know about the former Raging Cajun star. When we come back, though, here on RP3 and Company, Home Run Derby's tonight. Do you care? We'll ask that and more right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. You also can find us on the Simulcast, ladies and gentlemen, Stadium Network. That's 32.1. That's free over the air, 24-hour sports coverage. You can also find us on LUS Fiber, 133 and 1133 in high definition. Home Run Derby's tonight. Home Run Derby is tonight. Eight stars are going to be slugging it out for a $1 million prize. No one asked me to take part in this. I feel disappointed. Maybe if it was how many hot dogs I can eat. And not like in the Nathan's hot dog contest. First of all, Cody, gross. They dip the hot dogs with the bun in the water. What are you doing? I saw Joey Chestnut. He had like 70 hot dogs. I love hot dogs. Okay? The Parch household is big on the hot dogs. I'm also a big bologna guy. Okay?
I like bologna too.
Okay? So.
It's funny. I got super lucky on 4th of July. We were outside doing, you know, the family thing you do. There's a swimming pool and there's barbecue to be happening. So we were doing that normal thing. And then I went inside because it was hot. Very, very hot. So I went inside just to go chill in the AC for a little while, and I threw on the four-letter network just to see what was going on. And I happened to notice that on the Deuce, there it was, the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. And I got so excited. I was like, I can't believe I'm that lucky guy that happened to sit down right as it started. So I got to see the intros. You know, the little guy in the funny hat?
Yeah.
He does the crazy intro. He says, the battlefield, they call the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest the battlefield on which Lucifer and God battled for the right to the planet Earth, and they were correct. Like, it was an amazing, his entrance, they're great. It was hilarious. And then to watch those dudes eat so many. I was dumbfounded. I couldn't look away. It was gross. As gross, because I made Kaylee come in and watch it. I rewinded the DVR, watched it. It's grossly amazing.
They dip them in water.
It's an American pastime.
And you get the bun. First of all, I don't want my bun soggy, okay? No. Unless it's filled with delicious condiments.
Joey Chestnut afterwards said he about midway through his 10 minutes, he started chewing more so they'd be easier to swallow in his throat. So he's not even chewing half of these hot dogs.
Just wet, soggy bun. No, man. No,
hey, shout out to Adrian Morgan, our shout-out to the Boot, our local professional eater. He ate like 70-something dozen Acme oysters. He's been on the station, friend of the station, Adrian Morgan from New Orleans, professional eater. He was ranked like 11th in the world. So just a little shout-out to the Boot there. They were represented well at the Nathan's Hot Dog
Eating Contest. I feel like professional eater is probably the calling that I've missed out on.
What happened, man?
Oh, as you can see, I kept my amateur status, but I'm a champion. I'm like the Gold Gloves champion of eating, as I am in a few of my friends' phones, as not Raymond, but as Three Bills. I enjoyed the hot dog eating.
But I enjoyed the hot dog eating contest and all its grossness.
So gross.
And what's funny is Joey Chestnut eats 71 hot dogs. He is the fourth person to go over 70 hot dogs at Nathan's, but the three other people have done it once each, I think, and Joey Chestnut's now done it like five times just himself. He was sad, though, during his interview, his post-eating interview. Joey, you know, how you feel? You're another champion, 12th mustard belt a dozen times, man. How does it feel? And he was, I wanted the record. He's like, I was going for 75. I'm sad. I think he said the people came out here to watch this. They stood in the heat. They wanted to see a record. I wanted to give them a record. He's like, and I'll be back next year, and I'll get that 75 dogs.
What happened to Kobayashi?
I think he retired, or he just doesn't.
He was a guy that Chestnut dethroned, right?
Right. Yeah. And then Matt Stoney, out of nowhere, beat Joey Chestnut like 2 or 3 years ago at this. And everybody was like, ooh, is Matt Stoney the new, you know, Joey Chestnut, more or less? And that, no. Matt Stoney's still a very good, I think he's ranked third in the world, but Joey Chestnut just had a bad day a few years ago on the 4th of July.
Bad day.
It was grossly incredible.
Grossly is a good description. Don't dip your hot dogs in water. Stop it. They're delicious. You're eating delicious Nathan's hot dogs as it is. don't dip him in water. I know it's a competition. I don't need to know the rules.
You'll love this, too. Joey Chestnut threw out a first pitch at a Mets game before the 4th of July. So
that seems appropriate.
That's what I figured you'd like that.
The Mets. Gross. Tonight, though, is the Home Run Derby.
Another American pastime.
Here's your competitors. Once again, 8 guys will be teeing it off tonight on the mothership at 7 o'clock. And look, it's not to say that the Home Run Derby has not given us great moments, okay? Mark McGwire had that great home run back in 1997. Remember when Jim Thome bounced the ball off a building back in 1999? There's been some great home run derbies. Hell, Bryce Harper winning it last year.
I'll go even more recent.
The hometown guy.
Yeah, just last year with his dad throwing BP to him, too, on top of that. Heck yeah.
He didn't even make an all-star game this year, did he? You'll have to look that up on I don't think he made the all-star game. Signed $400 million contract, doesn't make an all-star game the next year. Wise move, Phillies. That's why you're behind my Braves.
Yes!
Your 8 competitors tonight. A's third baseman Matt Chapman, who's a late replacement for the Brewers' Christian Yelich, who's dealing with an injury and had to pull out of the Home Run Derby. Blue Jays rookie sensation Vladimir Guerrero Jr. I'm old enough to remember when Vlad Sr. got called up to the big leagues. Of course, Astros own and former LSU star Alex Bregman for the second straight year. Dodgers' Jock Peterson. The Mets are actually sending someone, Pete Alonso. Gross.
He's got like the third most home runs in the majors, though, Pete Alonso. So he's got that. This is one thing. Give him his one thing.
I will give him his one thing, and you know what? But no, I won't, because he's a Met, and I hate the Mets.
The jersey's getting him.
I hate the Mets. I have a disdain for the Mets. But good for him, and I'm sure since he's a Met, he'll get injured, or they'll trade him away for a bucket of garbage.
That's so terrible.
A bucket of garbage. The Indians, Carlos Santana. The Pirates, Josh Bell. And, of course, my bravo, Ronald Acuna Jr. Oh, he's so good. He's such a good young player. Those are going to be your competitors. Look, Bregman is going to be in it. He was in it last year. And, you know, this will be the second year. And he talked a little bit about who is going to be throwing him the pitches and how he's excited about taking part in this derby.
Win Home Run Derby.
Oh, it's going to be a blast. It's going to be a lot of fun. Hobby's great. He throws BP every day. He never misses a spot, so it's going to be a lot of fun. And hopefully we go up there and win the thing.
Alex says.
So there you go. Alex Bregman. He's ready. He's excited. It's his second year.
I wonder why he would pick the guy. I'm going to butcher his last name here, but I'm going to say it's Javi Bracamonte is what I'm going to go with. He's a Stroh's bullpen catcher. And that's been, because if we're going to, as much as you can break down a home run derby, the breakdowns go about as far as they don't wear helmets and who is throwing the ball to them. That's about as far as the breakdown goes. So, no, Alex Bregman will not be wearing a helmet. And two, a bullpen catcher is going to be throwing to him. And I mean, and you heard Bregman say, he never misses a spot. He's great.
Is he the guy that throws BP for Bregman? Is that just one of those things where since Bregman got called up that that's his guy that throws him BP?
It doesn't say that. It just calls him a bullpen catcher. He said it does say that he throws batting practice to Astros hitters. So maybe he's not the Alex Bregman specific, but he's in that rotation of the handful of guys that throw BP.
And I also like the fact that Bregman's bringing a guy that, you know, hey, you're the backup, you're the bullpen catcher.
Yeah.
Hey, you come to be part of the All-Star game festivities. So big up for Bregs for doing that.
I like that.
This is an extremely young field. Okay.
That's a good thing.
$1 million prize is the richest, but the average age of the field, 25.43, is the youngest in the 34-year history of the event. Last year's had been the youngest. 33-year-old Santana is the oldest. He's the only participant in his 30s. Four of the 8, Guerrero, 20, Acuna, 21, Alonso, 24, and Bregman, 25, are all under the age of 25 or younger. Guerrero is the youngest participant ever. And the inclusion of Guerrero and Acuna marks the first time multiple players under the age of 22 are taking part in the Home Run Derby. Now, it's done in a bracket, okay? So it's going to start off on one side of the bracket. Matt Chapman's going to take on Vlad Guerrero Jr. And Bregman is on that side of the bracket. He's going to be taking on Jock Peterson of the Dodgers, okay? On the right side of the bracket, It'll be Pete Alonso for the Mets. Gross. Versus Carlos Santana of the Indians. And then Josh Bell of the Pirates is going to be taking on Acuña Jr. of the Braves. So, my question to you is this. We know Bregman is enjoying it. He gets to take part in it. And these younger guys, I love the influx of youth here for the Home Run Derby. I love the fact that some of the youngest stars in our game that we love, by the way, RP3 and company, we're big baseball people here. I love it. I love the influx of youth for the second year in a row, that the younger players are wanting to take part in the Home Run Derby, that it means something to them. But I'm going to ask a question. You know what? We're going to make it our poll question. That's right. We're going to post this on the 103.7 The Game website, 103.7thegame.com. You can find it on the right-hand rail of our homepage. Does the Home Run Derby still matter? It does to me. I still enjoy watching it. It's not like the slam dunk contest for the NBA All-Star Game. That's lost its luster over the years. I still enjoy the Home Run Derby. Cody, do you still enjoy watching the Home Run Derby?
I do. I think it's fun. I will, admittedly, I will watch it sporadically tonight. I probably won't be tuned in because Raw comes on tonight. But
obviously,
I will be tuned in sporadically back and forth, watching for sure. I want to go. I have a prediction for this. I'm curious would like to throw out a winner.
Let's do it.
I'll give you my finals and my winner. My finals are going to be Vlad Guerrero Jr. He's going to beat Alex Bregman in the second round or in the semifinals of that bracket. So I'm going to go with Vlad Guerrero Jr. coming out of the left side. And then I'm going to go with your guy, Ronald Acuña Jr. I'm going to say he comes out of the right side, but then Vlad Guerrero Jr. wins the whole thing.
I'm going to be bold. You ready? Are you ready?
I'm ready.
You ready for this boldness from the RP3? As much as I want my boy Ronald Acuña Jr. to win this thing, I'll be rooting for him. I'm picking Pete Alonso.
Good pick. Good pick.
Come out of the Mets.
Good pick.
Give it up for the Mets. They need the love to come out of the right side of the bracket and for him to take down Jock Peterson of the Dodgers. I'm going with the upset of Bregs in the first round.
Awesome.
I'm going with Bregs.
And also, for full disclosure, Bryce Harper, not an all-star.
I'm so petty, but I hate my NL East rivals. I just can't help myself. That's good for you, Philly.
Like, I'm surprised they didn't put him on the AL team. They could have just slapped him on there.
Oh, man. Great show so far. We got to hit a break, though. You're listening to RP3 and Company right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. You can also find us on the Simulcast Stadium Network 32.1. That's free over the air, 24-hour sports coverage. You can also find us on LUS Fiber 133 and 1133 in high definition. Coming up, hour number three. It's jam-packed. We got not one but two guests lined up for you. David Grubb from CrescentCitySports.com. Be coming up, breaking all things Pels for us at 8:32. We'll lead off hour number three, though, with Jeff Palermo at 8:02 from the Louisiana Radio Network and co-host of Tiger Rag Radio to talk all things LSU. But before we do that, I want to wrap up the hour talking about the LSU baseball team. We talked about there'll be some type of change to the coaching staff for Paul Maneri and the Tigers for the 2020 season. And sure enough, it's occurred. The LSU baseball team has added Tulane assistant coach Eddie Smith to the coaching staff. That's because a certain volunteer hitting coach, is no longer on said staff. D1Baseball.com's Kendall Rogers reported yesterday that Smith will take over as the volunteer coach and hitting coach for Sean Ochinco, who is no longer with the program. No word on why Ochinco is no longer with the program, if it was his decision or decision that was forced above him, but the man who's been the hitting coach for the past few seasons and has been criticized for the lack of consistent hitting and the fact that the hitting has been down the last few years than where it was before the last time the Tigers went to the College World Series. Some people thought Oshinko was just not a very good fit for LSU. He is now out, and Eddie Smith from Tulane is in as the volunteer coach and hitting coach for Paul Maneri. Smith has been a member of the Tulane staff for the past three seasons. He's been the hitting coach and third base coach, as well as the recruiting coordinator for Green Wave coach Travis Jewett. Once again, the news wasn't, when it came out initially, it wasn't known who Smith was would be replacing on Maneri's staff, but then we saw the reports that, in fact, Oshinko had was no longer with the program. Responding to a text from the Advocate late Sunday afternoon, Maneri said he could neither confirm nor deny changes to his staff. Michael Bonnet, Sports Information Director at LSU, declined to confirm the hire. We quote, we can't confirm anything regarding personnel until they've cleared the background check, which is this case will be at the end of the week, end quote. But Kendall Rogers from D1Baseball.com is the one that kind of reported on it. What do we know about Smith? Well, he's a native of Washington State. He played 2 years at Notre Dame. He was a senior in 2006 as a member of the last Fighting Irish team that was coached by Paul Maneri. That's right. He played for Paul at Notre Dame. Before joining the Tulane staff the past few seasons, Smith was the head coach at Lower Columbia College. That's a real thing. That's a real place. I looked it up just to be safe. Lower Columbia College. That's a junior college in Longview, Washington. He's also been an assistant at Virginia, Notre Dame, and Santa Clara. So this is a guy that comes with some experience. Okay, he's been a head coach before. He's been an assistant for Power 5 programs. He played for Paul. And he's been an assistant inside the state of Louisiana, so he already kind of knows the lay of the land, so to speak, by spending his time at Tulane. He was named the 2015 ABCA Diamond Pacific Association Division National Coach of the Year when he was at Lower Columbia after his team finished the season ranked 10th nationally. In all, during his tenure there, he had 27 players receive Division I opportunities. So he was a coach who helped get guys to the D1 level. You come play for me, two-year college, I'm going to get you an opportunity to play at the next level. He was at Virginia from 2007 to 11. He helped the Cavaliers win three ACC titles and went to the College World Series twice in five seasons there. So this is a guy who's been on staffs that have gone to College World Series. This is a guy who's been a very successful head coach at the junior college level, developing D1 talent, taking guys out of high school that may not have been ready to play for a Power 5 conference and flipping them into Power 5 players. He knows the lay of the land here as the former recruiting coordinator for Tulane, and he played for Paul Maneri. Diehard Tiger fan, Cody Schutz, he nods his approval of this hire. Yes.
I nod two times.
Two times. We'll talk more about this.
Last time LSU got a hitting coach from Tulane, worked out pretty well.
It did work out pretty well, didn't it? We'll talk more about this hire plus all things LSU football because SEC Media Days is only a week away with our next guest, Jeff Palermo, the Louisiana Radio Network and co-host of Tiger Rag Radio. He'll join us to lead off hour number three. You're listening to RP3 and Company right here on Acadiana Sports Station 103.7 The Game.
Live and local, we are Acadiana Sports Station 103.7 The Game. KLWB Karen Crow Lafayette. It's time for RP3 and Company, where Raymond Parch III and Cody Schutz talk sports with the biggest names in the state of Louisiana. LSU All-American Skylar Green.
You know, as a young athlete growing up, you always want to do the game-winning something, the game-winning shot, game-winning catch. And I thought the biggest part for me right there, that Georgia catch, that solidified everybody seeing that LSU for real.
Ragin' Cajun hoop star Alfred Payton.
It's exciting to be able to represent, you know, your city, you know, somewhere where you grew up at and put that jersey on. See that says New Orleans on the front of it. I think it means a lot.
Time to find out what's behind that door as RP3 and Company starts now.
Welcome back to the show. You're listening to the Acadiana Sports Station 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. We're also simulcast on Stadium Network 32.1. That's free over-the-air 24-hour sports coverage. You can find us there every weekday morning from 6 to 9. You can also find us on LUS Fiber 133 and 1133 in high definition. But right now, it's time for us to head out to the ARCO Equipment Hotline as we welcome on our first guest of the day. He is part of the Louisiana Radio Network. He's also co-host of Tiger Rag Radio. It's the one and only Jeff Palermo. Jeff, how are you doing this morning? How was your holiday weekend, my friend?
Oh, it's a good weekend. Good weekend. Not exactly a four-day weekend, but three of the days I was off, so I'll take it.
you'll take whatever you can get, brother.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Well, Jeff, I want to get right into it, man. We didn't expect to hear some LSU baseball news of any significance over the holiday weekend, but sure enough, we got some yesterday. It was announced that Eddie Smith, a former Tulane assistant coach and recruiter, is joining the staff as LSU's volunteer coach slash hitting coach. We know his background. He played for Paul Maneri at Notre Dame. He's a former head coach for a junior college that was very successful, turning guys into D1 prospects. And he's been to the College World Series as an assistant at Virginia a few times. What do you make of the hire, and what do you make of that he's replacing a guy on staff in Sean Ochinco?
Well, a bit surprising considering right after the season, Coach Paul Maneri said he didn't expect to make any changes with his staff. Now, this might not be, we don't know just yet. Coach Paul Maneri is not confirming or denying the report. They're doing a background check on Eddie Smith before this becomes official, but I would imagine sometime this week an official statement will come from LSU. Coach Paul Maneri said at the conclusion of the season that he didn't anticipate any changes with his coaching staff. Sean Ochinco, a former player of his at LSU, who's been the recruiting or has been the hitting coach and a volunteer coach for LSU, just completed his second season. So, we'll see. This might have been a decision by Sean to move on to something else. You know, as the volunteer assistant coach, you're not a full-time coach, and it's a difficult position. I mean, the other two full-time coaches for Coach Paul Maneri are Nolan Kane, who is the recruiting coordinator, and then, of course, Alan Dunn, the pitching coach. So not exactly sure, what role Eddie Smith will have. Will he be the recruiting coordinator here, or do they keep Nolan Kane in that position? So more to be sorted out to see what exactly the staff looks like. But I know a lot of LSU fans love taking shots at the hitting coach, no matter who it is, when LSU has a hitting slump, or only scores a couple of runs a game for a certain stretch. So it's always been a tough position at LSU, but really the main guy who's the hitting coach is Paul Maneri. He's the guy that really sends the message to these players when it comes to their approach and exactly, what he'd like to see from them. I mean, any kind of changes to their swing or anything like that, I mean, Paul Maneri's got major input in. So while maybe on the surface this looks like a significant change, I don't know whether this is this is not going to mean all of a sudden Eddie Smith's going to make these guys all 300 hitters. That's not exactly how it works, but it'll be interesting to see what Paul says about it. A little bit more information on it, and we kind of can figure out whether this was something that after a while Paul Maneri said, you know what, I need to make a change here, or else Sean Ochinco decided to do something else with his life, which is quite possible that that's the reasoning for this.
We're talking with Jeff Palermo of the Louisiana Radio Network, also co-host of Tiger Rag Radio right here on the ARCO Equipment Hotline. That being said, you know, we're still waiting for LSU to confirm. We're still waiting to have a reaction on Paul Menary if this was a decision that he made or, like you said, Ochinco decided just to step away and said, okay, I'm no longer going to serve in this capacity. What do you think of Eddie Smith as a coach and his resume, Jeff?
Well, what we have seen here recently with any kind of hires, Paul Menary has been in particular hiring guys that he's had a connection with. You mentioned that Eddie Smith played for him at Notre Dame. You know, Paul Menary took a took a chance on Andy Cannizzaro, you know, a Tulane guy who Paul really didn't have much of a connection with other than, you know, saw him play and competed against him when Andy was at Tulane. And in the end, you know, I think Paul Menary was hurt in the manner that Andy Cannizzaro eventually left him to become the head coach at Mississippi State. And I really do think that since that time, Paul has really looked to hire guys on his staff that he can truly trust. You know, if a guy wants to make a move professionally or personally or whatever it may be, that, you know, Paul is not caught blindsided like he was with the Andy Cannizzaro decision to move from LSU to Mississippi State. So for him to hire a guy that he's been connected with, knows a little bit about, recruited, that's not a surprise at all.
We're talking with Jeff Palermo here of the Louisiana Radio Network, also co-host of Tiger Rag Radio on the ARCO Equipment Hotline. I want to talk a little summer league, Jeff, because I had no idea that Cavell Bigby Williams was going to be playing in the summer league for the New Orleans Pelicans. It flew under the radar, but he goes out there and had back-to-back games of double-doubles. What did you think of his performance, and what do you think is the likelihood he actually signs a contract to be with the Pels?
Yeah, I was surprised just like you to see. I mean, the whole focus heading into Saturday night's game, or I guess it was Friday night's game, was Zion Williamson. So you didn't, you kind of really didn't look too much at the rest of the roster, but there he was. And, you know, he does a lot of little things for you. You know, he's 6'11", he's athletic. He was really a kind of a glue guy for LSU basketball this past season. But you know, they play again tonight against the Bulls, and you figure if he has another good performance, there's a really good chance that he signs with the Pelicans. And if he doesn't sign with the Pelicans, he's got a chance to land on somebody else's roster, maybe as a two-way player, who knows. You know, it's just hard to, you know, the whole summer league thing. I mean, this has become such a big thing now in the middle of the summer, and the games are well attended and they're well watched, but you can get a little bit carried away with some of the performances. You got to remember, these guys are basically competing against guys of their age and their experience. You know, let's see what Cavell Bigby Williams can do when he goes up against a veteran player. You know, a guy that's been around the league quite a bit. It changes a lot, but Good to see him perform as well as he does, as well as he has so far. And we'll see if he can keep it up here tonight. You know, again, they play the Bulls. I don't know how much scouting goes in, how much game planning goes into these games, but I would imagine the Bulls coaching staff is well aware of Cavell Bigby Williams and will do more to try to minimize his impact in tonight's game.
We're talking with Jeff Palermo, the Louisiana Radio Network, right here on the ARCO Equipment Hotline. Jeff, I want to talk about two hires that occurred last week, and I want to get your thoughts on them. First is Will Wade adds veteran Kevin Nickelberry to the staff for next season. What do you make of that hire, and what do you think of Nickelberry, what he can bring to the table?
Well, he's a guy that's got some strong roots in the D.C. area, or in that kind of northeast part of the country, and Paul Menary has not been afraid to go out there and recruit kids from that area. Of course, you know, Tremont Waters was from Connecticut, you know, they just, in their latest recruiting class here, they got a kid from the Baltimore area, James Bishop. So It's been an area. Charles Manning is a guy that's originally from New York, but even though he played at Florida Southwest Community College. Marlon Taylor, another guy from the New York area. They got a kid, Andre Hyatt, from the Bronx. So they've kind of recruited this area quite a bit, the northeast part of the country. And so Coach Nickelberry gives you a little bit of the experience there. He's also obviously a guy that Paul Menary, Will Wade, is well familiar with. When Will Wade was a student manager at Clemson, Nickelberry was an assistant coach there, so he was connected with. He basically replaces what Tasman Mitchell's role was on the staff before. You know, Mitchell has been promoted to assistant coach, so he's kind of the Nelson Hernandez is director of basketball operations, but Nickelberry is in that role as well. So, and let's just face it, with the state of where the basketball program is, and you don't know when a potential hammer may drop on this program. And getting a guy like Kevin Nickelberry, a guy that Will Wade is familiar with, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, he wasn't. You know, I don't think there's a lot of coaches that are actively looking to join Will Wade's staff just because you don't really know about the future. So Kevin Nickelberry, who was the head coach at Howard for many years, probably wanted to get back to a Power 5 school, looked at this as an opportunity, has faith that Will Wade will remain the head coach here. So, again, I think on the surface it seems like a decent hire, but, I mean, Greg Heyer and Bill Armstrong remain the top two assistants on Will Wade's staff, and they are the biggest pieces to the puzzle when it comes to recruiting and game planning.
We're wrapping up things here with Jeff Palermo, the Louisiana Radio Network, as well as co-host of Tiger Rag Radio on the ARCO Equipment Hotline. Jeff, your thoughts on bringing on a college football Hall of Famer and a man who was one of the best to ever do it, national championship winner at USC and also coached the Los Angeles Rams to not one but two NFC championship games, bringing on John Robinson as a consultant to Ed Orgeron. Your thoughts on that hire?
Well, this is another guy. I mean, the consultant hires have been all the rage in college football the last couple of seasons. It's something that Nick Saban has utilized quite well to his benefit, and I think a lot of other schools are looking to try to do the same thing. You're talking about an 83-year-old man who will be a consultant. He obviously knows a lot about football. I don't know how much he knows about, the run-pass options and all this other stuff that LSU plans to implement offensively. But, again, another guy that Ed Orgeron trusts. I mean, that's kind of the theme here today is guys that you trust. Ed Orgeron and John Robinson, I'm sure their paths crossed many times when Coach O was an assistant coach at USC. John Robinson probably still around the program quite a bit, considering the status that he has there, as you mentioned, winning the national championship with the Trojans back in 1978. So I think it's just a guy for Coach Orgeron to bounce some ideas off of. Whether it is game planning or different things they can do in practice. I get the sense that Coach Robinson has probably been out of the game a little bit, though, as far as really having much of a daily impact on a program. But I think as far as these consultants go, you can't have enough of them around. There's no really limit to them. So you have a limit to your coaching staff, so if you can get some extra help, and if John Robinson gives you one piece of advice that helps you win a game, then it's a great hire, right? I mean, there's really not much risk in bringing him on.
Jeff, one final question. Do we know yet? SEC Media Days will be next week there in Hoover, Alabama. We're all gearing up for that. Do we know who Coach Ed Orgeron is going to be taking with him? What players are going to be there with him as part of SEC Media Days?
I think you'll have Grant Delpit there. I think you should. Maybe Rashard Lawrence will be there. Joe Burrow should certainly be there. I would think those would be your three. We haven't heard yet. Obviously, that's news that's going to come down sometime this week. LSU is on the first day, July 15th. They were on the first day last year. So, but I would think those would be your main guys that I mean, Burrow and Delpit, I would think, are right up there. And who knows, maybe a Michael Divinity could be another guy that they bring up there if they don't want to bring Rashard Lawrence, who's trying to recover from an injury. So those are probably your names, but Joe Burrow for sure, because he's great in those interviews. He's kind of an intriguing guy, gives you a lot of perspective. So you hope LSU brings guys of interest, and Joe Burrow is certainly interesting to say. He always says something that and gives you some knowledge and good tidbits, informing you on what's happening with the program.
Jeff, appreciate you making time for us as always. Brother, enjoy your week, and we'll talk to you next Monday.
Sounds good. Appreciate it, Ray.
It's Jeff Palermo, Louisiana Radio Network, as well as co-host of Tiger Rag Radio, joining us talking all things LSU. We touched on baseball, basketball, and football. Woo, trifecta. We got to hit a break, but when we come back here, we'll talk about the fact that the Los Angeles Lakers championship hopes rest on the fact that they've reassembled the 2017-18 New Orleans Pelicans team, minus Drew Holiday. We'll dive into that when we come back right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. We're also simulcast on Stadium Network 32.1. That's 24 hours of sports coverage free over the air. You can also find us on LUS Fiber 133 and 1133 in high definition. Coming up at 8:32, David M. Grubb from CrescentCitySports.com is going to join us talking all things Pels Summer League hoops action. But right now I want to take a moment to talk about what the Los Angeles Lakers are trying to do. Now look, the Lakers thought they were going to have themselves a trifecta, a big three, right? They made the trade for Anthony Davis. They gave up half their team to get him and all of their future draft picks, essentially. And they were going to sign another Supermax player, and they didn't get another guy. They didn't get a point guard. They didn't get anything. But they were banking on getting Kawhi Leonard, two-time finals MVP. They were going to poach him away from the Toronto Raptors. And instead, they woke up over the weekend and found themselves not with Kawhi, as Kawhi Leonard made the decision to sign with the Los Angeles Clippers, and then had the Clippers send off a total of 5 picks and a player to get Paul George away from the Oklahoma City Thunder. So now, no big three for the Los Angeles Lakers, a dynamic duo for the Clippers that you have to share a building with there at the Staples Centers in Los Angeles. And now the Clippers are the favorites to reach the NBA Finals or to win the NBA Finals. So you miss out. Kawhi Leonard spurred you. Once again, another player spurs the Lakers. This has become a recurring theme over the last couple of years. Paul George has done it. Now Kawhi Leonard's done it. Others have done it. So what does LeBron, Clutch Sports, Rob Pelinka, who, by the way, set up a terrific dinner meeting with Heath Ledger to discuss his performance in The Joker with Kobe Bryant.
As That's we know. Terrible.
That is terrible. What do? They got LeBron James. They got Anthony Davis. Anthony Davis waived his $4 million trade bonus so they could have more money to sign a max player, and they don't get a max player.
It is amazing. That is amazing.
But hey, LeBron James gave up his number 23 to Anthony Davis and apparently posted it last night in a parking lot of, the only thing I can describe, it looks like a parking lot of a strip mall. And he handed him a jersey with the number on it. I don't understand things. So they do all that.
Well, didn't LeBron, he wore 23, right?
He wore 23. He's giving up 23 for Anthony Davis. It's a nice gesture.
Did we need a physical Instagram post
of parking lot picture?
Passing
no.
of the jersey. I don't know if we need that.
No one needs that.
How much of the Kawhi decision to go to that side of LA and not the other side of LA has to do with Frank Vogel v. Doc Rivers?
Oh, the coaching is far superior. You get Doc
but
Rivers.
Is that, do you think that weighed into Kawhi's to say he wants to play for Doc more than Frank Vogel?
We heard reports Kawhi is a private guy, and Kawhi doesn't want to hear about anybody's nonsense, and he doesn't want to hear about leaks. And we heard about leaks coming out of Toronto, and we heard a lot of leaks coming out of the Lakers, right? And their front office is a mess. You don't hear anything bad about the Clippers, do you? Didn't hear a single leak. Stealthy. And he's got a billionaire owner who wants to win right now in Steve Ballmer. So what do the Lakers do? Miss out on yet another free agent? Well, they go out and they decide to essentially recreate the 2017-18 New Orleans Pelicans roster. They sign free agent center DeMarcus Cousins to a one-year deal. Then they sign Rajon Rondo, brought back to the Lakers on a two-year deal. So they got Anthony Davis, DeMarcus Cousins, or Rajon Rondo. They have the old Pels. Or, as someone else pointed out, they also have members of the old Sacramento Kings from a couple years earlier, 2015-16. And they keep just adding guys left and right. They re-sign Pope to come back. They got JaVale McGee coming back. Woo! Time to hang up a banner in the Staples Center. Those are all championship pieces. No, they're not. They're not. Lakers got played again, and good for them. When we come back here on RP3 and Company, we'll talk with David Eben Grubb, breaking down all things Pels for us right here on Acadiana Sports Station 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Acadiana Sports Station 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. We talked earlier in today's show about the Summer League debut of Zion Williamson, a brief 9 minutes, but some sensational moments there. Plus, there was an earthquake, and Cavill Bigby Williams making a name for himself out in Vegas. We'll dive deeper into all things Pels with our next guest. He is a contributor for CrescentCitySports.com. He's also the host of Hard in the Paint with David Grubb, which will be debuting next month on Sports 1280. We welcome back to the program the one and only David M. Grubb. David, how you doing this morning, brother?
I'm doing well. Thank you for the introduction. That was nice.
Anytime, man. Appreciate you making some time for us. I want to get right into it. And look, I'm still trying to pinch myself a little bit knowing that we're talking Summer League basketball and the Pelicans, and it's July. But that's where we're at right now, and thankfully so. Your thoughts on the brief debut, but still the debut of Zion Williamson for the Pels there in the Summer League in Vegas on Friday?
Yeah, the first thing is just the dramatic difference in the way we're all looking at Summer League. Last year, it was all about watching Frank Jackson debut, a second-round pick who missed his entire rookie year. And this year, we're talking about the most heralded rookie in the league in Zion Williamson and a number of other players who will be legitimately competing for spots on this roster. So that's exciting. And then when you look at Zion, you saw exactly what you expected in the first game. You saw his incredible strength. You saw his otherworldly athleticism. You saw his ability to rebound. And you saw his ability to defend and move. But they're also the things that every rookie has to work on. He's not as aware defensively as you might like. He took some bad shots. His three-point shot does not look very good. His free-throw shot has a very flat arc to it. So you see when it hits the rim, it comes right back at him. So those are things he's going to have to work on. And clearly he wasn't in his best physical shape. That's to be understood somewhat because, you know, he hasn't played any competitive basketball since Duke was eliminated from the NCAA tournament. And then, of course, he goes on all the tours, the awards circuit. He's been wined and dined for 2 months. But at the same time, you want to see him actively getting himself into peak physical condition. Hopefully by them resting him after his debut the rest of the summer, you'll see him focusing just on that because he does have to be careful. At 285 pounds, you don't want to see him start to creep up into the 300-pound territory on that body frame. You want to keep him in as best shape as possible and decrease that kind of, you know, when guys explode like that, the biggest pressure is on their knees and their backs. So you want to make sure that, you know, he stays healthy. But otherwise, you have to be encouraged because you got what you were looking for in that debut.
We're talking with David M. Grubb here on the ARCO Equipment Hotline. David, does the slight injury, the knee-to-knee, just give David Griffin the great excuse, the out, to be able to pull him Zion out of the rest of the summer league games and just have him work on his conditioning, which he mentioned in the statement. He was very specific about the conditioning. Does this just give him that excuse?
Yeah, I mean, we saw it again with Frank last year. You know, Frank Jackson played one game. It got everybody really excited, and he had a little bit of a nick, and they kept him out the rest of the summer. When you have these guys that you know are going to make your roster, and the thing that you're really looking for is them to understand your system and develop, summer league isn't always the best place for that. It's really for guys fighting for a spot. That's where you're seeing that kind of competition. And you don't want to put Zion out there with a guy who's competing for a 13th spot on a roster or looking for a European job who's going a little too overzealous and could possibly injure your franchise player. So get him back in the practice gym, have him work on conditioning, have him work on strength, have him get understanding of what he's going to have to do in his role and take those extra days to work on it. Because practice is not where you develop your skills. I mean, games are not where you develop your skills. It's in practice. So the more practice for Zion, the better.
We're talking with David M. Grubb. He covers the New Orleans Pelicans as well as LSU Sports for CrescentCitySports.com here on the ARCO Equipment Hotline. You mentioned someone in your opening answer, David, I want to circle back to, because for me, a guy that kind of stole the show, especially on night number one, was the former Duke guard, Frank Jackson. We've been talking a lot about, do the Pels need to make a move? Do they need to find a backup point guard behind Lonzo Ball? If Frank Jackson is healthy, is he that guy?
I still worry about Frank. He didn't show a lot in his ball handling. He didn't really create for other people. We know he can score. We saw it last year. There are moments when he can absolutely score the basketball. But he's going to have to be able to play both guard positions to really stick. Because you look at that two-guard position with J.J. Redick, with Josh Hart, with Etuan Moore, all still on the roster. It's going to be hard for Frank to compete for minutes at the one and the two if he can't improve his ball handling. I think the Pelicans are really high on him. The coaches want him to succeed, but this could be a numbers game for him. So I think he has to show that he can run an offense and not just score points. Because in a second unit, there are a lot of guys who can score individually in the NBA. I mean, they don't make it to the NBA if they couldn't score occasionally. But a lot of them need help. They need somebody who can get them the ball in position to score. And if there's no clear-cut backup point guard, which there isn't right now, somebody's got to step into that void. And the most likely candidate to do that is Frank Jackson. So I want to see him step up as a decision-maker and as someone who can create offense for others. He only had one assist in that first game. So he's got to get that up and start at least getting guys in position to score and running the offense a little bit more.
We're talking with David M. Grubb here on the ARCO Equipment Hotline. Let's talk about the former LSU star who I wasn't even aware was going to be part of the summer league for the New Orleans Pelicans, and that's Cavell Bigby Williams. He was a great glue guy at LSU. I think if you don't have him on that roster, I don't think they make the run to the Sweet 16, David. And, you know, he goes undrafted, yet he had a pair of double-doubles for the Pels. What do we know of his chances of signing a contract with the Pels? Has he been offered one? I know there's been some conflicting reports there.
I don't think he's been offered yet. There is interest, clearly. I thought Cavell Bigby Williams was the most pro-ready of all the LSU players last year because his skills naturally translated. Rebounding is something that you can take at any level, and he was their most dogged rebounder. And as we've seen, he's averaged 12 rebounds a game over these first two, 13 points a game in these first two, shooting 66% from the field. Cavell Bigby Williams doesn't need plays run for him. He's a guy who gets into the spaces with his activity, can hit the offensive boards. You know he can finish if you get him the ball in the paint. And even on the move, he has good hands to finish around the rim. He showed he could hit a mid-range jumper or two. I think he's just one of those guys that every team benefits from. Like you said, a glue guy. He has Rodman-type activity. I'm not comparing him to Dennis Rodman and saying he's a Hall of Famer. But he's got that type of activity. Great second leap. He can protect the rim. I just think that if he doesn't stick to this roster, because, there again, it's a deep front court, too, for the Pelicans. You're looking at Christian Wood, Jahlil Okafor, Zion Williamson, Jackson Hayes. You know, you have a ton of guys coming back, and Mealy from Europe coming in. So you already have five, six guys in your front court rotation. It's going to be hard for him to make the roster. I do think the G League, if he wants to stay with the Pelicans, I think the G League is a very real opportunity. But I would not be surprised if there's another NBA team out there that takes notice of him and his skill set and says, You don't have to pay this guy a lot. You don't have to run plays for him, and he can do things for you. He absolutely could develop in 2 years from now to be a solid rotational player in the NBA. So I think there will be interest for Cavell, and I don't see why there shouldn't be. I've been high on him the entire year that he was at LSU. I thought his maturity, his understanding of what it takes to play your role, and I think in summer league that's what you're really looking for is guys who can define their role and excel in it. He doesn't do anything outside of his skill set, but what he does within his skill set, he does with tenacity and with great ability.
David, I want to get your thoughts on what occurred in Los Angeles over the weekend. And just your initial thoughts. Kawhi was very stealthy, which we should have all expected. Signing with the Clippers, he spurns the Lakers for the Clippers, which he should have because the Lakers are a dumpster fire. But they also get Paul George. Your thoughts on what occurred with the Clippers getting two of the top 10 players in the league, and they'll also be playing for a coach like Doc Rivers now?
Well, at the trade deadline, when Jerry West and the rest of the Clippers front office did what they did to clear the space by moving Tobias Harris and acquiring picks, I thought that they were in great position then. I thought they were going to make a great run at Anthony Davis. They just didn't want to part with those young players. Well, now you get yourself into a position where Kawhi Leonard says, I'll come if you can get Paul George. And if you're Oklahoma City, yeah, technically they got a better haul than the Pelicans as far as what you look at players and picks combined. But that's Jerry West. I mean, you're looking at now an executive who's built four franchises. He built up the Lakers. He built up the Grizzlies. He built up the Golden State Warriors, and now he's doing it again with the Clippers. And I think when he walks into a room, there's a level of credibility there. And combine that with the desire for Kawhi to go home. I don't think he ever wanted to play for the Lakers. When he's been asked, he said, well, you know, my family were Laker fans. I was more of a Allen Iverson fan or whatever. I think he wanted to be in L.A., but he did not want to enter into a situation where you're going to be debating with LeBron James and Anthony Davis for who is the leader of that team. There's no doubt that the Clippers are Kawhi's team. Paul George is his friend and can come along and has always been better as a complimentary guy than as a lead guy. So you have two of the best perimeter defenders on the wing. You add in Patrick Beverley with that. I think the Clippers will be an elite defensive team. Montrezl Harrell, also a great defender. So the Clippers will be great defensively. I think that they put themselves in the top four in the NBA, obviously, in that conversation. And I think ultimately what you're seeing is front offices, the way that they're constructed, are just as important as the players that you have. Cap space doesn't matter anymore if you can't demonstrate to players that you can win and that you can win now, because they're signing 3- and 4-year deals. So they want to be able to be put in a position to win immediately, and they want to be able to know that their front office is going to do what it takes to make that happen. And I think when you look at the Lakers, you have no reason to believe that Rob Pelinka and the rest of the front office there has any idea how to sustain something. They're reaching for greatness, whereas the Clippers have built an infrastructure, as did the Brooklyn Nets, as have the Toronto Raptors, as have the Utah Jazz, the Indiana Pacers. You see these teams that are collecting talent this summer. They all have strong front office leadership. That's why the Pelicans now are now included among the teams to finish in the top eight in the West. Leadership. They've attracted players who can contribute to winning. And I think that was the main factor for Kawhi in this.
David, I want to talk about the other team that shares a home in the Staples Center, and that's the Lakers. You know, they clear all that space. Anthony Davis waives the $4 million in the trade bonus so they can sign another Supermax guy. And all we heard was they're going after Kemba Walker. They're going to get Kawhi. Or they're going to get Kyrie Irving. Or they're going to get Jimmy Butler. Whatever it might have been. And they flame out. And now they're building up a roster around LeBron James, Anthony Davis, and Kyle Kuzma with guys who were on the 2017-18 New Orleans Pelicans or before then the Sacramento Kings. And DeMarcus Cousins, Rajon Rondo. I know national media looks at it and they're like, well, look, the Pels made the playoffs that year, but I think people forget the Pels didn't get into the playoffs until after Boogie got hurt, and then Rondo and Davis were able to find, you know, kind of work together. That's not always been a great harmonious relationship between the three guys. Why do people think it's going to be that way in L.A.?
Because people didn't pay attention. You know, like you said, the Pelicans overall in all the games that Cousins and Davis played together, they were well under 500. They were one of the worst defensive teams in the league with Anthony Davis and DeMarcus Cousins on the floor together. There was a genuine, and this is not something that people make up. Being in that locker room, there was a genuine feeling of Anthony losing his team to DeMarcus, while at the first half of that season, DeMarcus was getting all of the MVP buzz. There were times when Anthony left the locker room early while the media was waiting for DeMarcus, and he wouldn't speak to the media at all. I got reports from people within Anthony's circle that they were telling him to his face, you are losing your team. So there was not this harmonious relationship that the two of them now portray. When he left, I also know that Rondo, when DeMarcus was injured, not that he was happy that he was injured, but Rondo was happy that the offense could now run the way it was intended to, with more ball movement. And you saw that. You saw Anthony go to a new level once DeMarcus was off the floor. The Pelicans, during that stretch run to the playoffs, the big difference was not that they got better offensively. They were a middle-of-the-pack team offensively in the last half of 2018. But they were a top-five team defensively. Who was missing from that group? DeMarcus Cousins. There were no times where he was the last man back in transition. There were no times when he gave a half-hearted effort under the basket anymore. You had Emeka Okafor playing 10 minutes and giving more defensively than DeMarcus was an entire game. And now you're talking about Rondo, 2 years older, when he was one of the worst defensive guards in the league then, was worse last year. He's 2 years older and can't defend up top. Now you can take DeMarcus, who's not a great defender, and he's 2 years removed away from injury each of the last two seasons. So now how good is he going to be? You had the other guys you're talking about, Danny Green, cannot handle the ball, can defend and can shoot the three, but cannot handle the ball. So you're starting five. If it's Rondo, Danny Green, LeBron James, Anthony Davis, and Kyle Kuzma, you have two ball handlers in Rondo and James, and only one of them can kind of shoot. Rondo can't shoot. Danny Green's not going to create for himself. Anthony Davis relies more on assisted baskets than any other star player in the league. And Kyle Kuzma is a terrible defender and a streaky three-point shooter. I don't think things are as rosy for the Lakers as people want to portray. I think they'll make the playoffs most likely, but I don't see them as one of the three or four best teams in the NBA.
David, appreciate your time as always, man. Great stuff. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Yes, sir. You have a good one as well.
That's David M. Grubb, covers the Pels, LSU, others for CrescentCitySports.com. He's got a new radio show coming up in New Orleans, Hard in the Paint on 1280 down there in New Orleans. That'll be debuting next month. Great stuff from David. When we come back here on RP3 and Company, we'll have to wrap up today's show. It was tremendous. We'll try to finish it off strong right here on Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game. Programming reminder. I know. You're like, Ray, we just got out of the holiday break. I got something special, though, for you lined up. The good brother, Ben Love, host of Bumper to Bumper Sports, is going to be live Wednesday from the Quick Slant 7-on-7 there at STM's Cougar Field. He'll be broadcasting Bumper to Bumper Sports live from 4 to 6. So make sure to tune in for that. That's going to be appointment listening. You know he's going to deliver the goods there from the Quick Slants 7-on-7 there at STM's Cougar Field. Also, check out the Good Brothers weekly reboot podcast. It's up and running right now. It's up on the website. It's also available to be downloaded. Top five reasons to be optimistic about 2019 LSU football. The Good Brother Ben Love's weekly reboot podcast is now available to download. So make sure to check that out as well. Coming up later today, the Jordy Holberg Show live once again, 2 to 4 with Uncle Jordy. Full 3 hours of Bumper to Bumper Sports from 4 to 7. And then no Astros baseball today because obviously it's the All-Star break. Home Run Derby is tonight. Also, ladies and gentlemen, Houston Astros Weekend Getaway Sweepstakes powered by Lafayette Roofing and Aloft Houston Downtown is back. You can enter to win 4 tickets to a Saturday and Sunday game and a one-night hotel stay August 3rd and the 4th. That's Astros versus April champions, the Mariners. So make sure to go and take part in the Houston Astros weekend getaway. Sweepstakes powered by Lafayette Roofing and Aloft Houston downtown. Just enter to win four tickets for a Saturday and Sunday game and a one-night hotel stay, August 3rd and 4th, Astros versus Mariners. Tremendous show. Want to thank all of our callers, including both Jameses. I want to thank Cody Schutz for delivering the goods. And once again, congratulations to Team USA for winning the Women's World Cup. Dan Patrick Show is next. Y'all have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.